Second case this morning is case number 56663, Miles v. State. Mr. Storms for the appellant. Mr. Shefalakwa, am I correct?
Skipalakwa,
pretty close. Skipalakwa, as counsel for the state. And Mr. Reed is watching over Mr. Storms.
I don't need to watch over Mr. Storms, but I do appreciate it. May it please the court, Jeremy Storms, public defender, on behalf of Anika Miles. We're here today, Your Honors, specifically to ask you to reverse this case based upon a structural error because of the Batson violations here. One Batson violation in of itself would warrant reversal of the case. In this instance, we have two Batson violations. Batson violations occur because of a violation of the equal protection rights of both the defendant, the excluded juror, and also they're there to promote confidence in the fairness of our justice system here. Specifically, I'd like to talk first about Claudia Benjamin Robinson. This is the first juror or panelist that the state moved to strike. She was the seventh challenge the state brought. She was the first African-American woman the state moved to strike. And in this case, Ms. Anika Miles was also an African-American. The district court inquired of the state as to why they were striking Ms. Benjamin Robinson. And their explanation there in this case was that they didn't like her body language, that she seemed disengaged, that she seemed hostile, that she didn't laugh at jokes.
We don't have any factual finding by the district court confirming that, correct?
And that's correct. I think that under Snyder versus Louisiana, the court didn't actually address those issues, so I don't think they're really part of the record here. Something that we use as a basis to determine whether or not this was a peremptory challenge. Sorry, a pretextual challenge, excuse me. But what they said otherwise is that her job was one where she was a manager and that she said that she had no issues at work. She had no problems with people at her job. She's a workforce manager at Sprint. Sprint is a large company. Ultimately, she wasn't really asking questions as to what her job entailed. She works in human resources in a large company with the human resources department. Often, a person might just be shuffling paper. They might just be approving requests or denying them and not actually having any actual interactions with someone who's making those requests. So here, ultimately, there weren't any questions asked by the state to establish whether or not the fact that she works in management in a human resources department was something that would put her in a position to actually have to do some real conflict resolution. And under Miller L. would suggest that them not asking those questions and then using this as a basis to strike her belies the fact that their basis for striking her was pretextual. In this case, when it comes to their questioning of her and her conflict resolution, we have a number of other jurors that expressed a similar not exactly engaging in conflict forthright, but trying to avoid it in some manner. For instance, Mr. McCollum, when asked by the appellant about how he would address a self-defense issue, said that his feet are how he addresses a self-defense issue, that he would run away from a conflict. Likewise, Ms. Rash, who the state ultimately did strike, said that she was a teacher, and what she would do to address a conflict would have her students talk the conflict out.
But there's a bit of a difference that I think in the context of a peremptory challenge as opposed to a for cause challenge, as I understood it, the concern was that the woman was not forthright, that it was sort of unbelievable that you would have that job and have no conflict with your coworkers, and that gave rise to wanting to make a peremptory challenge there. It wasn't just that she's so harmonious with her coworkers that she would be a lay down on the jury, but rather that she was not being forthright in her answers. So I'm not sure your comparative juror analysis flies. Am I wrong on that?
I agree with the court that it's a different basis for challenging her to a degree. But ultimately, we don't have the record on that issue. They did not inquire of her on that issue to really give any flesh to their allegation that it seems incredulous. I think that as professional people, hearing someone in the management position might imply that you do have the sort of duties over other people that are underneath you that you're managing. But I would submit that for a large company such as this, for someone to be in human resources, it doesn't mean that they actually have to deal with a conflict resolution. They might simply be logging paperwork, making sure that schedules are produced appropriately, things of this nature. And so the state did not really ask those questions or have a record to really make that claim and have it have any basis. Then I'll move on to Denise Robinson, who was the second juror that the state moved to strike. She was the ninth juror. She was the alternate. They said that they moved to strike her because she said she might become tired. Ultimately, what she had said in court, when asked by the district court, she said that she had a hard time sitting and doing nothing for a long period of time. On one of the days of voir dire, I, as the appellant's lawyer, asked her if she was doing okay, and she was fine that day. She also engaged with us. She answered panel questions. She talked about a car accident she was in. It was a relevant question in the voir dire in this case as to whether or not someone had been in a car accident. She also discussed with counsel her role as a juror and said she would have no issue coming back with any of the possible penalties in this case. She expressed some reservations about sitting for a long trial, but ultimately there were other panelists, based upon financial hardship, that said that it would also be difficult for them to do the same thing.
So her candor may have been commendable.
Exactly.
Well, falling asleep is a little different than the financial problem.
It is.
I may be thinking about money, but I can at least decide the guilt or innocence of a person. But if I fall asleep, I don't know what's going to happen.
I kind of had a similar comment, counsel. How would that be purposeful discrimination, though, to knock Denise Robinson off there based on those comments?
And again, her response as to that she might have a hard time paying attention was to the district court judge. It was, again, something that the state did not follow up with, did not ask her any questions about. They also, in this case, said that they observed her demeanor and said that at one point, whenever we were having a long bench conference, that she laid her head back and closed her eyes. I would say that a lot of jurors might do that for long bench conferences. And again, there was no record or finding made by the judge that anything about her demeanor affected her decision to grant the state strike in that instance.
I think what my colleagues want on these Batson charges is more information from the defense, not from the prosecutor, not from the judge. How do you respond to that?
And I would say to you, Justice Cherry, that particularly with respect to Claudia Benjamin Robinson, we did make a challenge to their allegation. We did say that she had, in fact, I'm sorry, I'm finding my place in my notes here, that she did volunteer answers. She seemed to be engaged. We did make a specific record.
And that triggers a duty to make a finding by the district court on those.
Yes, on the body language. And in this case, she did not. Those were the things that we addressed specifically in our response to for the state's basis for striking her and claiming that it was a neutral reason to do so.
All right. The judge doesn't make findings. Now what? How do we handle it from the appellate court? If it's supposedly structure error and we don't have findings, what does that mean?
Well, I think that there's case law to inform the court as to what to do in that point, and I think I would point the court to Miller L. For that matter. And in that case, the Supreme Court did actually do a larger analysis than was done in the state court on the issue. I think that it is ultimately the appellate court's duty to look into the record and evaluate it based upon the Supreme Court case law on this issue that does point out that if there's no actual questioning on the subject matter for which the state says they're making a race-neutral reason to strike, that suggests that there might not be a race-neutral reason to strike, that it might suggest that their reason is actually is actually one that's that is
pernicious. Yeah.
Yes.
I want to make sure I have my facts right. There were four African Americans seated on the jury in this case.
I believe so. Yes, in this case there were, and these were the two that they moved to strike. But of course, any Batson violation is structural error and would warrant a reversal of the case.
I would like to hear also about the closing argument and the argument that you're making, that it was permissible negative inference argument to say, you know, if there was evidence, the state surely would have presented it. I see that as very distinct from the Glover argument that was it split decision, but that held when you actually the defendant crossed over into making affirmative representations about what was on a videotape. This was more a negative inference. Could you comment on that and why that injured your clients, why it was harmful error?
In any case, the defense, by and large, attacks the state's evidence. We hold the state to their burden and argue reasonable doubt in the vast majority of cases. So when there's a lack of evidence, and this is not evidence that's been somehow precluded or not introduced by the state, but a lack of evidence, that's a very basic function of the defense attorney to argue that negative inference. And in this case, it was absolutely appropriate for Mr. Reed to do so, and it comes nowhere near the issues that were raised in the Glover case that I don't think that in any way the judge should have not allowed us to get into that line of argument.
Quickly, and I'm sorry to cut into your time, but how was it harmful?
Well, it's harmful because in this case, our defense was by and large our character. And to not allow us to also raise the inference, raise the issue that they have nothing to impugn our character with, leaves this possibility that there's something that wasn't presented to the jury, that the state was somehow not allowed to do something, and it wants to, unlike the Glover case where there was apparently some issue hanging out there, in this case where there was none, where there was absolutely nothing to impugn our character with, it implies that.
And the defense was, in this case, that your client was not the aggressor and it was an accident?
It was an accident, and that there's nothing in her character that would suggest that, or in her dealings with people across the whole span of her life, she would act in a violent manner.
Yeah, 3 minutes and 15 seconds left. You want to reserve that?
Please, Your Honor.
And for the state of Nevada.
My name is Mark Scafalacqua. I'm Deputy District Attorney here in Clark County, and I'm representing the state of Nevada in this matter. Start with the first issue, the Batson, and then move on to the negative inferences. In this case, Your Honor was correct. There was 9 overall challenges that we had. It was a life tale case, 7 of which were used on people who would identify as white or Caucasian. 2 were African American, actually seated on the jury itself, not in an alternate position, but actually who decided the case. There were 4 African-Americans.
So 4 actually decided the case?
4 actually. 1/3 of the jury was African-American, decided the case. Yes, Your Honor. In dealing with the first challenge to Ms. Benjamin Robinson, I think there's no real comparison here or the comparative analysis to the other jurors. True, other jurors were asked about self-defense or how would you act if somebody attacked you. That wasn't my questioning when I was with the jurors. It was more, how do you do conflict resolution? I asked this to all supervisors, a teacher, a casino floor person in this case, Mr. De La Rios. I just want to see how people work together and how they get to conclusions. I thought it was unbelievable in certain ways that someone who's in a supervisory role, which she said she was, who deals with payroll, with scheduling, has people under her, doesn't work with conflict or deal with conflict. Even good bosses deal with conflict. Judge Vega, in particular, I'm quoting her, says, I was like, wow, I do find that peculiar. Not just noting that I mentioned a race-neutral reason, but also that she was taken aback by it in that type of response. So in that case, that's what it was. I didn't think she was being forthright with her answer. In regards to Ms. Robinson, I don't think there needed to be a lot that was developed. Her quote, I kind of have difficulty staying awake for long periods of time if I'm just sitting doing nothing, and that might pose a problem, end quote. I certainly don't expect jurors to always agree with me. Certainly they didn't ultimately agree that this was a murder. that occurred in this case, but I do expect them to be awake. And she simply said she doesn't know if she can do that. I did make a record later on. This is Appellant's Appendix, Volume 4, page 841. She was sleeping at one point, or at least appeared she was sleeping when we came back. Her head was back, eyes closed. This is an important case, and I would think the defense would want someone who's staying awake too. And that was an issue. And going back to the comparative analysis that Your Honor brought up, no one else was sleeping or said that they couldn't stay awake. But we had to have them awake, and she was the only one not being awake actively. So, like I said, I don't think that, you know, under the recent decision in Hawkins, comparing it to other jurors, Ms. Benjamin Robinson's answers, they were different. I didn't think she was being forthright, and the other person was sleeping and said she wasn't sure if she could stay awake.
Do you believe the findings of the district court were adequate as to the juror whose traverse was expressly made by your opposing counsel?
I'm the first juror, the
non-sleeping
juror. Okay. It appears that Judge Vega just made a finding or a ruling with regards to kind of the second part of the reason why I chose to struck her, which was her communications with me, and I didn't think she was being forthright. I would agree, I don't think she made a record with regards to her body language. And I know that would be difficult for the appellate court because you can't see body language.
That's the same point we're trying to get.
Right, you couldn't. And the only thing I can say is there certainly is not much in the record for you to take a look one way or the other, because the court never made a finding. I do think it's sufficient, though, in what the court went to immediately. And I think that's because Judge Vega had the same reaction I had to the questionings and went just right to this and made that finding.
So lack of candor was confirmed by the "wow, that's peculiar" comment?
That's correct. Her saying the word "wow," I find that peculiar as well as the state did. So I'd agree there's not a record on that first part, but I think it's kind of goes in or rolls into her responses.
But there should be an ultimate finding as well, that in view of that it's non-pretextual and the challenge is rejected. I mean, the record could have been better in this case.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. I don't dispute that. I think it's more than adequate with me not believing she was forthright in how her answers were different than other people's answers who are supervisors. But I agree. There obviously could have been a little more with the body language part, because I know
we really can't review that. You don't have a record on that. So
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So I understand you're likely going to have to decide it on what Judge Vega ultimately says, and I'm comfortable with that. In regards to the negative inference in the Glover decision, if it's okay if I move on to that. Here was the problem with what the defense said. The defense said, and this is a quote, "Her character, her reputation is above reproach." Now let me add this. You can believe this absolutely for sure. If for a minute the prosecution had any evidence of any specific thing, any violent act besides what they believe they're accusing her of today, you can bet darn well they would have gotten up here and asked some witnesses about it. Anyway, here's my problem with this. The defense put forward several witnesses in the case, character witnesses for the appellant, and said that she's a person, give an opinion of nonviolence. How do you know her? I know her this way. What's your opinion if she's violent? She's nonviolent. The defense was very careful not to go beyond that, because there were other things about her character that I could impeach or go after. Were there specific crimes of violence? No. And that's why it was contained. But what they said was going too far. Her character is above reproach. You can believe this for sure if for a minute the prosecution had any specific thing, comma. And the way I took that is, violent or otherwise, if the state had anything, they would have cross-examined the witnesses about it. And that's why there was a problem with that, in my opinion, because, as the court knows, I couldn't cross-examine these witnesses about other convictions or other things like that. It would just be violence. And that's why this went too far, Your Honors. I would note, though, it was sustained. But then Mr. Reed went on and made the same argument focusing it on the violent part. And that was not objected to. So the argument came out one way or the other. You know, I think it's one thing to say that premising an argument on reasonable things, but in this case, Your Honors, I don't think that was fair to the state, and that's why we objected.
Yeah, the Glover case, though, goes into the ABA standards for criminal justice, and the fact that the defendant is able to argue, and I quote, "There are often circumstances in which defense counsel may be entitled to argue to the jury that they should draw an inference adverse to the prosecution as a result of its failure to bring forth some particular item of evidence or to call a witness." The vice in the Glover case was the specific representation that what was on that tape was deadly to the state, and that particular evidence had been excluded. So it was crossing the line from negative inference to affirmative representation of fact as to an excluded piece of evidence and what was on it. I'm troubled by your argument that this argument, we put up witnesses that show this lady's peace-loving and good-hearted. The state produces nothing, and you're saying they're not able to say, you know, if the state had something, surely to contradict this, surely they would have come forward with it. What's wrong with that?
If it was just left at that, Your Honor, there may not be much that's wrong with that. But here's where they went more. In court, you have an opinion as to her violent character. Yes, she's a peaceful person. It's just to that. What's now in closing argument? Her character overall, not peacefulness, going to what she argued, is above reproach. You can be sure of this. If the prosecution had any specific thing, not just violence, but anything. That's why I objected, because...
So it's really a mischaracterization of the record evidence.
That's right.
Putting in evidence facts that aren't...
That's exactly right, because I wouldn't be able to cross-examine a witness who gets up there from the defense and says, she's a peaceful person. Well, did you know about X, Y, or Z conviction that this defendant may have? If it's not a violent conviction, I couldn't do that. So what they're saying is they took it a step further and said her character overall is good. And you can be sure about that, because if the state had anything, violent or otherwise, they would have asked.
So you would not have objected if they'd stuck with, if the state had anything to demonstrate she was not a peace-loving person.
And not only wouldn't I have necessarily objected to, I didn't. He then changed the argument from the character overall to just what Your Honor was saying.
Okay, tell us what you could have gotten in then, if in fact this had been presented in the defense. What would you have put forward?
If they had witnesses that just came up and said she's a person of good character,
right?
Not just violence, right? Probably
that's outside the record at this point.
No, but I want to know what he would say. He's made an allegation that he could have done something. I want to know what he could have done.
No problem. There was probably 4 or 5 different soliciting prostitution convictions. There was a petty larceny arrest or citation, trespass arrest or citation.
But they're not admissible.
Well, if someone, Your Honor, were to get up there and say that she is a person of good character and leave it at that and then sit down, I think some cross-examination of that would be
wrong. Give me a case. Tell me a case that justifies your position or not.
Well, this is why my objection was, and if it's okay, I'd like to quote you in your dissent, because it was a really good quote and it applies here. "Clearly, it would have been unfair to raise a negative inference against the party for failing to present evidence when that party was precluded from presenting that evidence by the trial court." So what we have in the trial court is them having the witness saying it's a peaceful person. There's nothing else. If there's no violent convictions, I can't cross-examine it. That's real narrow. I'm limited. But to get up in closing and say if they had anything whatsoever about the character, specific, the violence or anything, that goes too far.
But don't you think that's what the jury was keying in on? This is a murder case.
Absolutely.
This isn't a case or anything. It doesn't have to do with somebody stealing some change off a dresser or something.
You're absolutely right.
So I think that the jury was keying in on violence, and I think that they were keying in on violence, and I just think you were maybe misreading what the final argument actually was.
And when they honed it after the objection, and they made that argument, I didn't object. You know, that came out, Your Honor. So my whole problem was with them saying, overall, the character is good. If they had any specific thing, because that went above and beyond what was presented or potentially what I could have gotten into at all. So that was more my issue. If you look right below it after the sustaining of the objection, he argues that hones it in to what Justice Pickering was talking about. The argument came out either way, Your Honor. So that was more the objection.
Well, let's say we find it's there. Is it harmless?
I believe it is, Your Honor, because taking everything as a whole, the argument came out. The argument he wanted to argue that she's a person who's peaceful and this would be uncharacteristic of her, he made that argument. It all came out. It's only my objection was limited to saying other things other than violence, because that wasn't presented in court, and that was my problem with it. So I do believe it's harmless because their argument was there. It came out.
Anything else?
No, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Rebuttal, please.
Thank you. To briefly address the closing argument issue. Here, the character, the charge was violence. When the state can impeach someone on a violent charge, it can impeach them with specific instances of violence by the accused. And that just wasn't here. There's nothing improper about arguing that because it was true. There was nothing there for them to impeach her on and her character on that particular issue. To assume that we were making an improper argument there, I think, is just not correct based upon the evidence here and what they had to try to impeach any of our witnesses.
But it sounds like he was able to argue, and we were talking about the nonviolent type stuff.
Yes, but ultimately, the court not allowing us to go further with us in that did not allow us to argue the inferences as to them not having no real evidence of her having any violence in her character. Whatever Mr. Reed was able to do after the sustained objection, he could not drive home that fact that not having specific instances of violence that they can impeach her with goes to that reasonable doubt and goes to the ultimate issue in this case. And ultimately, character issue evidence is a huge piece of evidence for the defense. A case can be won on character evidence, and by not allowing us to get into that in this case, it was error.
Okay, why is it harmful, though? Tell me why it's harmful and not harmless under the facts and circumstances of this case. I mean, it was a murder case originally, right?
Yes.
And she got convicted of manslaughter.
That's correct.
That's like a win, at least it used to be when I was a public defender. But so tell me why it's harmful.
It's harmful because ultimately in this case, what the jury decided against what our argument was is that it wasn't an accident. There was a malicious act here, that there was some sort of criminal conduct by Miss Miles, and to not allow us to get into and further hone the argument that ultimately she has never done a violent thing in her life, and her intent here was not to do something malicious and cause the death, prevented us from really arguing what would ultimately be our point, that she's just not guilty of a crime here. This is an accident, not a criminal act. So that's how it's harmful in this case.
Anything else you want to say on the Batson?
I would say that the state's conceding there's not really findings here for the judge to have considered Ms. Robinson's demeanor. She didn't ultimately make a ruling on whether or not she thought she was truthful or not. And what we have is a record that's devoid of anything as to whether or not the judge looked at her demeanor and thought that she was not being quite truthful whenever she's answering and saying she doesn't have conflicts at work. And then we're left with just the record that she works at a large organization where in her position, though it might be managerial, it's not one where she's necessarily coming in contact with people and having to resolve issues. And so what she said was credible.
Now, what about the fact that 4 African-Americans sat on this jury?
Ultimately, it's a structural error if there is a Batson violation. It doesn't matter that there's 4 other African-Americans on the jury. Any African-American or any protected class struck improperly warrants reversal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel for their arguments in this matter. Very interesting. And this matter will stand submitted. We're in recess.